too. Abaddon was furious. Once the Interrex envoys had returned to their vessels, he withdrew with the others of the Mournival and vented his feelings.
6 months! 6 months warring on murder! How many great deeds, how many brothers lost! And now he apologizes, as if it was an error, a mistake! These Xenos-loving bastards even admit themselves the spiders were so dangerous they had to lock them away.
It's a difficult situation, Loken said.
It's an insult to the honor of our legion, and to the angels too.
It takes a wise and strong man to know when to apologize, remarked Aximand.
And only a fool appeases aliens, Abaddon snarled. What has this crusade taught us?
That we're very good at killing things that disagree with us, suggested Torgadon.
Abaddon glared at him.
We know how brutal this cosmos is, how cruel. We must fight for our place in it. Name one species we have met that would not rejoice to see mankind vanished in a blink.
None of them could answer that.
Only a fool appeases aliens, Abaddon repeated, or appeases those who seek such appeasement.
Are you calling the War Master a fool? Loken asked.
Abaddon hesitated.
No, no, I'm not. Of course. I serve at his will.
We have one duty, Aximand said. As the Mournival, we must speak with one mind when we advise him.
Torgadon nodded.
No, said Loken. That's not why he values us. We must tell him what we think, each one of us, even if we disagree, and let him decide. That is our duty.
Meetings with the various Interrex envoys continued over a period of days. Sometimes the Interrex ships sent a mission to the Vengeful Spirit, sometimes an Imperial embassy crossed to their command ship, and was entertained in glittering chambers of silver and glass, where the Aria filled the air. The envoys were hard to read. Their behaviour often seemed superior or condescending, as if they regarded the Imperials as crude and unsophisticated. But still, clearly, they were fascinated. The legends of old Terra and the human bloodline had long been a central tenet of their myths and histories. However disappointing the reality, they could not bear to break off contact with their treasured ancestral past. Eventually, a summit was proposed, whereby the War Master and his entourage would travel to the nearest Interrex outpost world and conduct more detailed negotiations with higher representatives than the envoys. The War Master took advice from all quarters, though Loken was sure he had already made up his mind. Some, like Abaddon, counseled that links should be broken, and the Interrex held at abeyance until sufficient forces could be assembled to annex their territories. There were other matters at hand that urgently demanded the War Master's attention, matters that had been postponed for too long while he indulged in the 6 month spider war on murder. Petitions and salutations were being received on a daily basis. 5 Primarchs had requested his personal audience on matters of general crusade strategy or for councils of war. One, the Lion, had never made such an approach before, and it was a sign of a welcome thawing in relations, one that Horus could not afford to overlook. 36 expedition fleets had sent signals asking for advice, tactical determination, or outright martial assistance. Matters of state also mounted. There was now a vast body of bureaucratic material relayed from the Council of Terra that required the War Master's direct attention. He had been putting it off for too long, blaming the demands of the Crusade. Accompanying the War Master on most of his daily duties, Loken began to see plainly what a burden the Emperor had placed on Horus's broad shoulders. He was expected to be all things, a commander of armies, a mastermind of compliance, a judge, a decider, a tactician, and the most delicate of diplomats. During the 6 month war, more ships had arrived at high anchor above Murder, gathering around the flagship like supplicants. The rest of the 63rd expedition had translated under Varvarus's charge, 6319 having at last been left in the lonely hands of poor Rakris. 14 vessels of the 88th expedition had also appeared, under the command of Trajus Boniface of the Alpha Legion. Boniface claimed they had come in response to the 140th's plight, and hoped to support the war action on murder, but it rapidly emerged he hoped to use the opportunity to convince Horus to lend the 63rd strength to a proposed offensive into Orc-held territories in the Cavus Belt. This was a scheme his Primarch, Alpharius, had long cherished, and, like the lion's advances, was a sign that Alpharius sought the approval and comradeship of the new War Master. Horus studied the plans in private. The Cavus Belt offensive was a projected 5-year operation, and required 10 times the manpower the War Master could currently muster.
"Alpharius is dreaming," he muttered,
showing the scheme to Loken and Torgadon.
"I cannot commit myself to this."
One of Varvarus's ships had brought with it a delegation of Exector Tributary Administrators from Terra. This was perhaps the most galling of all the voices baying for the War Master's attention. On the instruction of Malkador the Sigillite, and countersigned by the Council of Terra, the Exectors had been sent throughout the spreading territories of the Imperium, in a program of general dispersal that made the mass deployment of the Remembrancers look like a modest operation. The delegation was led by a high administrix called Enid Rathbone. She was a tall, slender, handsome woman with red hair and pale, high-boned features, and her manner was exacting. The Council of Terra had decreed that all expedition and crusade forces, all primarchs, all commanders, and all governors of compliant world systems should begin raising and collecting taxes from their subject planets in order to bolster the increasing fiscal demands of the expanding Imperium. All she insisted on talking about was the collection of tithes. "One world cannot support and maintain such a gigantic undertaking single-handed," she explained to the War Master in slightly over-shrill tones. "Terra cannot shoulder this burden alone. We are masters of 1,000 worlds now, 1,000,000. The Imperium must begin to support itself."
"Many worlds are barely in compliance, lady," Horus said gently. "They are recovering from the damage of war, rebuilding, reforming. Taxation is a blight they do not need."
"The Emperor has insisted this be so."
"Has he?"
"Malkador the Sigillite, beloved by all, has impressed this upon me and all of my rank. Tribute must be collected, and mechanisms established so that such tribute is routinely and automatically gathered. The world governors we have put in place will find this too thankless a task," Malagurst said. "They are still legitimizing their rule and authority. This is premature." "The Emperor has insisted this be so," she repeated.
"That's the Emperor beloved by all?" Loken asked.
His comment made Horus smile broadly. Rathbone sniffed. "I'm not sure what you're implying, Captain," she said. "This is my duty, and this is what I must do." When she had retired from the room with her staff, Horus sat back, alone amongst his inner circle.
"I have often thought," he remarked, "that it might be the Eldar who unseat us. Though fading, they are the most ingenious creatures, and if any could overmaster mankind and break our Imperium apart, it would likely be them. At other times, I have fancied that it would be the Greenskins. No end of numbers, and no end of brute strength. But now, friends, I am certain it will be our own tax collectors who will do us in."
There was general laughter. Loken thought of the poem in his pocket. Most of Carcassi's output he handed on to Cinderman for appraisal. But at their last meeting, Carcassi had introduced something of the doggerel. Loken had read it. It had been a scurrilous and mordant stanza about tax collectors that even Loken could appreciate. He thought about bringing it out for general amusement, but Horace's face had darkened.
"I only half-joke," Horace said. "Through the Exectors, the Council places a burden on the fledgling worlds that is so great it might break us. It is too soon, too comprehensive, too stringent. Worlds will revolt, uprisings will occur. Tell a conquered man he has a new master, and he'll shrug. Tell him his new master wants a fifth of his annual income, then he'll go and find his pitchfork. Enid Rathbone, and administrators like her, will be the undoing of all we have achieved."
More laughter echoed round the room.
"But it is the Emperor's will," Torgadon remarked.
Horus shook his head.
"It is not, for all she says. I know him as a son knows his father. He would not agree to this. Not now. Not this early. He must be too bound up in his work to know of it. The Council is making decisions in his absence. The Emperor understands how fragile things are. Throne, this is what happens when an empire forged by warriors devolves executive power to civilians and clerics."
They all looked at him. I'm serious, he said. This could trigger civil war in certain regions. At the very least, it could undermine the continued work of our expeditions. The executors need to be sidelined for the moment. They should be given terrific weights of material to pour through, to determine precise tribute levels, world by world, and bombarded with copious additional intelligence concerning each world's status.
It won't slow them down forever, Lord, Malagas said. The administration of Terra has already determined systems and measures by which tribute should be calculated pro rata world by world.
Do your best, Mal, Horace said. Delay that woman at least. Give me breathing space.
I'll get to it, Malagas said.
He rose and limped from the chamber. Horace turned to the assembled circle and sighed. So, he said, the lion calls for me. Alpharius too.
And other brothers and numerous expeditions, Sanguinius remarked.
And it seems my wisest option is to return to Terra and confront the council on the issue of taxation.
Sanguinius sniggered.
I was not wrought to do that, Horace said.
Then we should consider the Interrex, Lord, said Erebus.
Erebus, of the Word-Bearer's Legion, the 17th, had joined them a fortnight earlier as part of the contingent brought by Barbarus. In his stone-grey Mark IV plate, inscribed with bas-relief legacies of his deeds, Erebus was a sombre, serious figure. His rank in the 17th was first chaplain, roughly equivalent to that of Abaddon or Eidolon. He was a senior commander of that legion, close to Corpheron and the Primarch, Lorgar himself. His quiet manner and soft, composed voice commanded instant respect from all who met him, but the Lunar Wolves had embraced him anyway. The Wolves had historically enjoyed a relationship with the Bearers as close as the one they had formed with the Emperor's children. It was no coincidence that Horus counted Lorgar amongst his most intimate brothers, alongside Fulgrim and Sanguinius. Erebus, who time had fashioned as much into a statesman as a warrior, both of which duties he performed with superlative skill, had come to find the War Master at the behest of his legion. Evidently, he had a favour to crave, a request to make. One did not send Erebus except to broker terms. However, on his arrival, Erebus had understood immediately the pressure laid at Horus's door, the countless voices screaming for attention. He had shelved his reason for coming, wishing to add nothing to the War Master's already immense burden, and had instead acted as a solid counsel and adviser, with no agenda of his own. For this, the Mornival had admired him greatly, and welcomed him, like Raldoron, into the circle. Abaddon and Aximand had served alongside Erebus in numerous theatres. Torgadon knew him of old. All three spoke in nothing but the highest terms of First Chaplain Erebus. Loken had needed little convincing. From the outset, Erebus had made a particular effort to establish good terms with Loken. Erebus's record and heritage were such that he seemed to Loken to carry the weight of a Primarch with him. He was, after all, Lorgar's chosen mouthpiece. Erebus had dined with them, counselled with them, sat easy after hours and drunk with them, and, on occasions, had entered the practice cages and sparred with them. In one afternoon he had bested Torgadon and Aximand in quick bouts, then tallied long with Saul Tarvitz before dumping him on the mat. Tarvitz and his comrade Lucius had been brought along at Torgadon's invitation. Loken had wanted to test his hand against Erebus, but Lucius had insisted he was next. The Mornival had grown to like Tarvitz, their impression of him favourably influenced by Torgadon's good opinions, but Lucius remained a separate entity, too much like Lord Eidolon for them to warm to him. He always appeared plaintive and demanding, like a spoilt child.
"You go, then," Loken had waved, "if it matters so much."
It was clear that Lucius strained to restore the honour of his legion, an honour lost, as he saw it, the moment Erebus had dropped Tarvitz with a skilful slam of his sword. Drawing his blade, Lucius had entered the practice cage, facing Erebus. The iron hemispheres closed around them. Lucius took up a straddled stance, his broadsword held high and close. Erebus kept his own blade extended low. They circled. Both Astartes were stripped to the waist, the musculature of their upper bodies rippling. This was play, but a wrong move could maim. Or kill. The bout lasted 16 minutes. That in itself would have made it one of the longest sparring sessions any of them had ever known. What made it more remarkable was the fact that in that time there was no pause, no hesitation, no cessation. Erebus and Lucius flew at one another, and rang blows off one another's blades at a rate of 3 or 4 a second. It was relentless, extraordinary, a dizzying blur of dancing bodies and gleaming swords that rang on and on like a dream. Abaddon, Tarvitz, Torgadon, Loken, and Aximand closed around the cage in fascination, beginning to clap and yell in thorough approval of the amazing skill on display.
"He'll kill him," Tarvitz gasped. "At that speed, unprotected, he'll kill him." "Who will?" asked Loken. "I don't know, Garvey. Either one," Tarvitz exclaimed. "Too much, too much," Aximand laughed.
"Loken fights the winner," Torgadon cried.
"I don't think so," Loken rejoined. "I've seen winner and loser."
Still, they duelled on. Erebus's style was defensive, low, repeating and changing each parry like a mechanism. Lucius's style was full of attack, furious, brilliant, dexterous. The play of them was hard to follow.
"If you think I'm taking on either of them after this," Loken began.
"What? Can't you do it?" Torgadon mocked.
"No."
"You go in next," chuckled Abaddon, clapping his hands. "We'll give you a bolter to even it up."
"How very humorous, Ezekiel."
At the 59th second of the 16th minute, according to the practice cage chron, Lucius scored his winning blow. He hooked his broadsword under Erebus's guard and wrenched the word-bearer's blade out of his grip. Erebus fell back against the bars of the practice cage and found Lucius's blade edge at his throat.
"Whoa, whoa now, Lucius,"
Aximan cried, triggering the cage open. "Sorry," said Lucius, not sorry at all. He withdrew his broadsword and saluted Erebus, sweat beading his bare shoulders.
"A good match. Thank you, sir."
"My thanks to you,"
Erebus smiled, breathing hard. He bent to pick up his blade.
"Your skill with a sword is second to none, Captain Lucius."
"Out you come, Erebus," Torgadon called. "It's Garvey's turn."
"Oh, no," Loken said. "You're the best of us with a blade," little Horus insisted. "Show him how the Lunar Wolves do it." "Skill with a blade isn't everything," Loken protested. "Just get in there and stop shaming us,"
Aximand hissed. He looked over at Lucius, who was wiping his torso down with a cloth.
"You ready for another, Lucius?"
"Bring it on!"
"He's mad," Loken whispered.
"Legion honor,"
Abaddon muttered back, pushing Loken forward.
"That's right," crowed Lucius. "Anywhere you want me. Show me how a lunar wolf fights, Loken. Show me how you win."
"It's not just about the blade," Loken said.
"However you want it," Lucius snorted.
Erebus stood up from the corner of the platform and tossed his blade to Loken.
"It sounds like it's your turn, Garvey," he said.
Loken caught the sword and tested it through the air, back and forth. He stepped up into the cage and nodded. The hemispheres of bars closed around him and Lucius. Lucius spat and shook out his shoulders. He turned his sword and began to dance around Loken.
"I'm no swordsman," Loken said.
"Then this will be over quickly."
"If we spar, it won't be just about the blade."
"Whatever, whatever,"
Lucius called, jumping back and forth.
"Just get on and fight me."
Loken sighed.
"I've been watching you, of course. The attacking strokes. I can read you."
"You wish."
"I can read you. Come for me."
Lucius lunged at Loken. Loken sidestepped, blade down, and punched Lucius in the face. Lucius fell on his back, hard. Loken dropped Erebus's sword onto the mat.
"I think I've made my point. That's how a lunar wolf fights. Understand your foe and do whatever is necessary to bring him down. Sorry, Lucius."
Spitting blood, Lucius's response was incoherent.
"I said we should consider the Interrex, sir," Erebus pressed.
"We should," Horus replied. "And my mind is made up. All these voices calling for my attention, pulling me this way and that. They can't disguise the fact that the Interrex is a significant new culture,
occupying a significant region of space. They're human. We can't ignore them. We can't deny their existence. We must deal with them directly. Either they are friends, potential allies, or they are enemies. We cannot turn our attention elsewhere and expect them to stay put. If they are enemies, if they are against us, then they could pose a threat as great as the Greenskins. I will go to the summit and meet their leaders. Zenobia was a provincial capital on the marches of Interrex territory. The envoys had been guarded in revelations of the precise size and extent of the Interrex, but their cultural holdings evidently occupied in excess of 30 systems, with the Heartworld some 40 weeks from the advancing edge of Imperial influence. Zenobia, a gateway world and a sentinel station on the edge of Interrex space, was chosen as the site for the summit. It was a place of considerable wonder. Escorted from mass anchorage points in the orbit of the principal satellite, the Warmaster and his representatives were conducted to Zenobia Principis, a wealthy, regal city on the shores of a wide ammonia sea. The city was set into the slopes of a wide bay, so that it shelved down the ramparts of the hills to sea level. The continental region behind it was sheathed in verdant rainforest, and this lush growth spilled down through the city too, so that the city structures, towers of pale grey stone and turrets of brass and silver, rose up out of the thick canopy like hilltop peaks. The vegetation was predominantly dark green, indeed so dark in colour it seemed almost black in the frail yellow daylight. The city was structured in descending tiers under the trees, where arched stone viaducts and curved street galleries stepped down to the shoreline in the quiet, mottled shadow of the greenery. Where the grey towers and ornate campaniles rose above the forest, they were often capped in polished metal and adorned with high masts, from which flags and standards hung in the warm air. It was not a fortress city. There was little evidence of defences, either on the ground or in local orbit. Horus was in no doubt that the place could protect itself if necessary. The Interrex did not wear its martial power as obviously as the Imperium, but its technology was not to be underestimated. The Imperial party was over 500 strong and included Astartes officers, escort troops and iterators, as well as a selection of remembrancers. Horus had authorized the latter's inclusion. This was a fact-finding mission, and the Warmaster thought the eager, inquisitive remembrancers might gather a great deal of supplementary material that would prove valuable. Locum believed that the Warmaster was also making an effort to establish a rather different impression than before. The envoys of the Interrex had seemed so disdainful of the expedition's military bias. Horus came to them now, surrounded as much by teachers, poets, and artists as he was warriors. They were provided with excellent accommodation in the western part of the city, in a quarter known as the Extranus, where they were politely informed all strangers and visitors were reserved and hosted. Zenobia Principis was a place designed for trade delegations and diplomatic meetings, with the Extranus set aside to keep guests reserved in one place. They were handsomely provided with meturge players, household servants, and court officers to see to their every need and answer any questions. Under the guided escort of Abrakari, the Imperials were allowed beyond the shaded compound of the Extranus to visit the city. In small groups, they were shown the wonders of the place. Halls of trade and industry, museums of art and music, archives and libraries. In the green twilight of the galleried streets, under the hissing canopy of the trees, they were guided along fine avenues, through splendid squares, and up and down endless flights of steps. The city was home to buildings of exquisite design, and it was clear the Interrex possessed great skill in both the old crafts of stonemasonry and metalwork, and the newer crafts of technology. Pavements abounded with gorgeous statuary and tranquil water fountains, but also with modernist public sculpture of light and sonics. Ancient lancet window slits were equipped with glass panels reactive to light and heat. Doors opened and closed via automatic body sensors. Interior light levels could be adjusted by a wave of the hand. Everywhere, the soft melody of the aria played. The Imperium possessed many cities that were larger and grander and more cyclopean. The superhives of Terra and the silver spires of Prospero, both were stupendous monuments to cultural advancement that quite diminished Zenobia Principis. But the Interrex city was every bit as refined and sophisticated as any conurbation in Imperial space, and it was merely a border settlement. On the day of their arrival, the Imperials were welcomed by a great parade, which culminated in their presentation to the senior royal officer of Zenobia, a general commander named Jeff Denaud. There were high-ranking civil officers in the Interrex party too, but they had decided to allow a military leader to oversee the summit. Just as Horus had diluted the martial composition of his embassy to impress the Interrex, so it had brought its military powers to the fore. The parade was complex and colourful. Meturge players marched in great numbers, dressed in rich formal robes, and performed skirling anthems that were as much non-verbal messages of welcome as they were mood-setting music. Glaives and sagittars strode in long uniform columns, their armour polished brightly and dressed with garlands of ribbons and leaves. Behind the human soldiery came the Kinnebrach auxiliaries, armoured and lumbering, and glittering formations of robotic cavalry. The cavalry was made up of hundreds of the headless artificial horses that had featured in the envoy's honour guard. They were headless no longer. Sagittars and glaives had mounted the quadruped frames, seating themselves where the base of the neck would have been. Warrior armour and robot technology had fused smoothly, locking the riders in place, their legs folded into the breastbone of the steeds. They were centaurs now, man and device linked as one, myths given technological reality. The citizenry of Zenobia Principis came out in force for the parade, and cheered and sang and strewed the route of the procession with petals and strips of ribbon. The parade's destination was a building called the Hall of Devices, a place which apparently had some military significance to the Interrex. Old, and of considerable size, the hall resembled a museum. Built into a steep section of the bay slopes, the hall enclosed many chambers that were more than two or three stories high. Plunging display vaults, some of great size, showed off assemblies of weapons, from forests of ancient swords and halberds to modern motorized cannons, all suffused in the pale blue glow of the energy fields that secured them.
"The hall is both a museum of weapons and war devices, and an armory,"
Jephthah Naud explained as he greeted them. Naud was a tall, noble creature, with complicated dermatoglyphics on the right side of his face. His eyes were the colour of soft gold, and he wore silver armour and a cloak of scalloped red metal links that made a sound like distant chimes when he moved. An armoured officer walked at his side, carrying Naud's crested warhelm. Though the Astartes had come armoured, the Warmaster had chosen to wear robes and furs rather than his battle plate. He showed great and courteous interest as Naud led them through the deep vaults, commenting on certain devices, remarking with delight when archaic weapons revealed a shared ancestry.
"They're trying to impress us," Axemand murmured to his brothers. "A museum of weapons. They're as good as telling us they are so advanced, so beyond war. They've been able to retire it as a curiosity. They're mocking us."
"No one mocks me," Abaddon grunted.
They were entering a chamber where, in the chilly blue field light, the artifacts were a great deal stranger than before.
"We hold the weapons of the Kinnebrach here," Naud said,
to Meturge accompaniment.
"Indeed, we preserve here, in careful stasis, examples of the weapons used by many of the alien species we have encountered. The Kinnebrach have, as a sign of service to us, forsworn the bearing of arms, unless under such circumstances as we grant them said use in time of war. Kinnebrach technology is highly advanced, and many of their weapons are deemed too lethal to be left beyond securement."
Naud introduced a hulking robed Kinnebrach called Asheroth, who held the rank of Keeper of Devices, and was the trusted curator of the hall. Asheroth spoke the human tongue in a lisping manner, and for the first time the Imperials were grateful for the Meturge accompaniment. The baffling cadences of Asheroth's speech were rendered crystal clear by the aria. Most of the Kinnebrach weapons on display didn't resemble weapons at all. Boxes, odd trinkets, rings, hoops. Naud clearly expected the Imperials to ask questions about the devices and betray their warmongering appetites, but Horus and his officers affected disinterest. In truth, They were uneasy in the society of the indentured alien. Only Cinderman expressed curiosity. A very few of the Kinnebrak weapons looked like weapons. Long daggers and swords of exotic design.
"Surely, General Commander, a blade is just a blade," Cinderman asked politely. "These daggers here, for instance, how are these weapons too lethal to be left beyond securement?"
"They are tailored weapons," Naud replied. "Blades of sentient metal, crafted by the Kinnebrak metallurgists, a technique now utterly forbidden. We call them anathemes. When such a blade is selected for use against a specific target, it becomes that target's nemesis, utterly inimical to the person or being chosen."
"How?" Cinderman pressed. Naud smiled.
"The Kinnebrak have never been able to explain it to us. It is a factor of the forging process that defies technical evaluation."
"Like a curse?" prompted Cinderman. "An enchantment?"
The aria generated by the Meturge players around them hiccuped slightly over those words. To Cinderman's surprise, Naud replied,
"I suppose that is how you could describe it, iterator."
The tour moved on. Cinderman drew close to Loken and whispered,
"I was joking, Garville. About the curse, I mean. But he took me seriously."
"They are enjoying treating us as unsophisticated cousins, but I wonder if their superiority is misplaced."
"Do we detect a hint of pagan superstition?"